Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to come here. It's really my pleasure to visit.
Can you please turn on your microphone?
Oh.
Oh, you're supposed to.
I see.
Yeah, there should just be a little switch just on the top there, or the belt pack.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, sorry, there's a switch on the belt pack that just needs to get turned on. It's on the very, very top.
Oh, I see. Okay.
How about this now? Can you hear me clearly?
Thank you very much.
Oh, great, great, great. So, are there any audience in the Zoom chat? So, in the Zoom, so maybe if they type in anything, can I see it? Because I don't see a Zoom or anything. So, it's only for recording, is that right? There wouldn't be anyone else online.
There is a Zoom, but we do have a Zoom link. So, I guess if there is a question, the audience can just yell.
I see.
Okay.
I see.
So,
because I haven't turned on Zoom on my laptop yet, so I'm not sure whether. Okay, I see. So I don't have to do anything locally. Okay, I just hand usually. Okay. So feel free to ask questions and let me know if this mic drops, so because I may not notice it. All right. So thank you for the introduction, and also thank you for inviting me to come here at Perimeter. It's my first time here. I'm really amazed by the beautiful environment here. I look forward to chatting with you more later today and also tomorrow. So I'm Pak Man Cham. I'm from Hong Kong. I did my undergraduate at HKUST from the same place as Chong. And then I move on to Penn and do my graduate study. So today I'm going to tell you about two of my recent work done collaboratively with Professor Charlie Kane, who is my supervisor, and Professor Martin Klesen, who is recently joined Penn. This will be my first part of the talk, focusing on this paper, starting from a quantum information perspective, telling us how to measure the topology of Fermi C. In the second part of the talk, I will tell you a bit about some experimental proposals that we made that would make it more feasible to measure the topology of a two-dimensional metal. So this is my formal title. Slightly more playful title would be how to count holes in a Fermi C without diving in. So hopefully this question will become a bit more concrete and clear in a second. But let me first begin with a hand-wavy cartoon picture that distinguishes between gapped phase and gapless phases. I know in the audience, there are experts in this field of logical quantum phases of matter. In this field, people usually focus more on gapped phases, and it's not too hard to understand why in gapped phases there is more likely to be topological and robust phenomena, because the presence of an energy gap tells us that it's hard to, you can't infinitesimally deform the system. You can't create an infinitesimal excitations because there's a gap. There's these regions, you're forbid to put in a quantum state there. You have to do something rather drastic to create a finite energy excitations in order to have an action on the system. Now, the story is quite different in a gapless systems, for example, in metals that we see in everyday life. You can actually create an infinitesimal excitations, and that is probably part of the reason that why metals are so malleable, and this feature may make it a little obscured if I tell you that there's actually some topological and robust properties of a metal. At the end of this talk, I hopefully will convince you that there are actually topological aspects of metals, and that can be probed in different manners. So for gapped phases, that's the main theme of topology in quantum matter. And the previous cartoon picture tells us that there are many topological phenomena that can be expected in gapped phases. For example, in a single particle regime, people talk about band insulators, and there are different examples in various dimensions. For example, integer quantum Hall, when you look at how the block wave function twists in the Brillouin zone, This defines a churn number, which in turn is related to a measurable quantized quantities. For example, if you look at the Hall connectivity, you can measure a quantized number that characterizes the topology of a single particle block wave function. The topology of the bulk wave function is related to quantized response and related to the presence of gapless boundary modes. So these are some physical things that is inside the topology of the bulk wave function. When you have strong interaction, talk about many-body physics, we have topological orders, for example, fractional quantum Hall states, quantum spin liquid states. Again, there's topology in the many-body bulk wave functions. As a consequence of that, for example, if you put your system on a closed manifold with different genuses, the ground state degeneracy depends on that. And it's a robust ground state degeneracy that is only sensitive to the topology of the spatial manifold where you put your system on. There are different works, for example, this one by Moore and Reed, which highlights a relationship between the bulk wave function and the theory on the edge. The bulk wave function can be seen as a conformal blocks that describes the gapless conformal theory that describes the gapless edge. So this in turn will give us, if you look at the edge, you have quantized transport, electrical or thermal transport. For example, the gapless, the thermal transport on the edge approaches the central charge C, which is again a robust number that reflects or manifests the topology of the bulk. Many things that I've talked about here are related to the topology of the wave function. And that is something that I'm not going to focus on today. I'm not going to focus on a gapped phase. I'm also not going to focus on the topology of wave function. I'm going to be interested in a gapless system, the metal, and look at the topology of the Fermi C. The ground state of the metal is defined by a region in the momentum space. It's bounded by the Fermi surface. So you have a Fermi surface of gapless excitations. You have many, many gapless excitations. And under the Fermi surface, you have occupied electronic states that define the ground state of the metal. Now, if you view your Fermi C as a geometrical object, it looks like maybe a ball or a bun or a pretzel with several holes. And you can ask about the topology of this object. You can characterize it with a number, which we're familiar with, the Euler characteristic. You basically count the number of holes in this geometrical object. And I'm going to call it chi f. I will define it more carefully on the next few slides and give you examples in various different dimensions. But let me just invoke the picture here first and just give us the motivation and the intuition. For example, if you take a graphene, you have a Dirac cone, you can dope it with electron or holes. In either ways, you will generate either an electron pocket or a hole pocket in the Brillouin zone. Okay. So this square schematically represents my first Brillouin zone. So this side and that side are identified. This side and that side are identified. The green region corresponds to the field electronic states. Okay. So I have an electron pocket here. This one, this guy is different from a hole pocket if you view it from a topological point of view, because you can draw a cycle here, and any cycle, any loop that you draw inside the electron pocket can always be contracted to a point. While in a hole pocket, you can draw this line, which is a loop, because this side and that side are identified. So this loop and this loop, these are two different loops that are non-contractible. So this distinguishes the topology between an electron pocket and a hole pocket. And in fact, if you use a definition of Euler characteristic, which I'll introduce in the next slides, this electron pocket, each electron pocket has an Euler characteristic plus one, each hole pocket has an Euler characteristic minus one. Okay. That's an example in 2D. In 3D, you have more varieties in some sense. If you look at sodium or potassium, the Fermi C looks like a ball. If you look at copper or silver or gold, the Fermi C is actually so large that the Fermi surface touches the boundary of the first Brillouin zone. And because of the periodicity of the Brillouin zone, your Fermi C actually has a weird connectivity. You can go to that side and come back on the other side, so that if you really stare at it long enough, you actually see that the Fermi surface of copper or silver or gold actually takes the form of a donut or a torus with four holes in it. It has a genus G equals to 4 for the Fermi surface. And if you look at the Fermi C Euler characteristic, actually equals to 1 minus the genus of the surface, which is equals to minus 2. So nature naturally gives us a variety of Fermi sea or Fermi surface topology. The Euler characteristic can range from minus integers to pretty high positive integers. Okay. Question? Yes, please.
There's also a property which I think maybe is kind of different from what you're saying, which is like the Fermi goes around the Bruin zone, so that you cannot like the Bruin zone really has to be a torus and not like
yes
cannot be lifted to a plane, like as implications for quantum oscillations.
Yes,
I think this is a little bit different from what you're talking about.
If I get your question right, I think it's related to what I'm talking about here. So, for example, you can ask about if you have a field band, a completely field band, then your Fermi C would extend over the whole Brillouin zone. The whole Brillouin zone has topology of a torus. That Euler characteristic is zero. For any torus, d-dimensional torus, the Euler characteristic is zero. So it is included in my discussion here. Does that answer your question?
Not quite, but I don't want to delay you, so I'll ask later.
Okay, so I will talk about the Euler characteristic in more detail, Euler characteristic for Fermi C in more detail in the next few slides, and you can feel free to raise the question again if you think it's relevant.
Maybe let me ask this. Possibly simpler version of that. So just take the 2D example. Suppose I have open Fermi surface. Is that case included?
That case is included, and I will talk about that example.
Okay.
I can give you the answer. That Euler characteristic is zero.
Okay.
Because the Fermi C that is a ribbon, it has a topology of the ribbon.
Okay.
That has a topology of a circle. It's a one torus. That Euler characteristic is zero.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll talk about that.
Okay, probably talk about it. But suppose I have some anomalous thing that I have only one chiral branch of the Fermi C. We know it's a bit weird, but in that case, do you see something weird from this?
That is probably an example that I haven't thought about.
Okay.
Yeah. Open Fermi surface, that's okay. I can consider that. Because I'm going to view the Fermi C as defined in the first Brillouin zone. So a case with an open Fermi surface, actually it is a geometric object. I can visualize it as a compact object. So my question here is, how do you can associate an integer to every metal, ordinary metal? Then how do you probe that? Is there any quantized response or correlation that is sensitive only to this number? Just like in a gapped, you know, integer quantum hole insulator, one can measure hole connectivity and extract this number without asking about how does the wave function looks like in the Brillouin zone. And then I do an integral of the very curvature in the Brillouin zone and then extract this number. I don't need to know like the detail about the topology of the wave function. I can actually do some simple experiment, extract that number. I want to play a similar game here for metal. So that is what I mean by counting holes in the Fermi C without diving in. So this is the plan of my talk. In the first part, I will tell you that how to use a density correlation function, which is in turn related to a multipartite number correlation function. These two things are presumably something that are, in principle, experimentally measurable. Okay. These are universal and can probe the topology of a d-dimensional Fermi C. And these things can be related to a multipartite entanglement measure that we call a multipartite mutual information. I will define that in detail in my talk. In particular, in this talk, I will explain how this mutual information can be related to this number correlation in a free fermion context. In our paper, we address situations where you add in Fermi-liquid interactions, and we have discussion on how Fermi-liquid interaction would renormalize some results, but not renormalize some other results. So we also have some more detailed discussion on that. But here, in this talk, let us be content with talking about free fermions, but in various dimensions, from 1 to 3.
Okay.
In the second part of the talk, I will talk about a concrete experimental setups that can be, and is a quantized transport experiment that can probe the topology of a two-dimensional Fermi C using a planar Josephson junctions. And we believe it's probably realistic to at least try to do such an experiment. In particular, planar Josephson junction recently have been used to hunt for Marana. So maybe some groups that have already devoted some effort into hunting for Marauders using plain agent injunction, can do some similar experiments, but using transport in the direction along the junction, instead of usually when people talk about Josephson current, they're talking about transport across the junction. But here we propose transport along the junction, which has a topological response that is sensitive only to the topology of a two dimension. Fermi C.
So practically, would this be easier than trying to get the Fermi surface from quantum oscillation?
In spirit, I think it's easier. In practice, people have been using quantum oscillation to get Fermi surface shape for several decades, so I'm not sure how to, you know, justly evaluate. But we can negotiate that. I think in spirit, it's actually a simple experiment.
Okay.
Yes. And it's amusingly, it has a rectification effect that looks like a rectification effect in diode, but has a topological origin. So it is robust in some sense. You can, yep.
Oscillations usually diode 3.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I'm not familiar with that one can do. Yeah, I think I think quantum oscillation experiment measures the two-dimensional Fermi surface in a 3D metal.
It measures the cross section.
Yeah, the maximal cross section on a Fermi C. Yeah.
And to know the Fermi surface topology, we in principle to know the shape, we have to do quantum oscillation from
in different directions. Yeah. In order to map out. Yeah. And I think people actually have to a priori write up a model for a unsought Fermi surface and see whether it matches with the oscillation results. So in spirit, I think it's more complicated. It involves many, many steps. And as you said, you have to point your magnetic field in different directions in order to have the whole thing. But okay, my results here is for 2D, and I'm not aware of a similar oscillation experiment in 2D. But I also don't have an experiment to propose to probe the topology of Fermi C in 3D. So maybe in some sense they are complementary. Yeah. So let me define the quantity of interest, or the characteristic. At least to me, this is the first thing that I'm exposed to when I try to learn about topology. I think people even before Euler that consider similar things, but it's now attributed to Euler, that if you take a convex polyhedra, and generally any graph, namely you have a collection of vertices, edges, and faces, and you count them, count the number of vertices as V, number of edges as E, and number of faces as F, and add and subtract them in the following way, then for any graphs that can be embedded on a sphere, you'll get a number 2. And for general graphs that can be embedded on a genus G surface, then this counting would always give you 2 minus 2G. So it doesn't depend on the geometric details of your graph, it only depends on the topology, the topological information of this graph. So on what type of surface can you embed your graphs on? And actually, more generally, you don't need a triangulation of your space in order to speak of the Euler characteristic. A modern definition of the Euler characteristic for generic topological space is to use this alternating sum of Betti numbers. The L of Betti numbers counts the number of L-dimensional holes, or non-contractible L-dimensional cycles in this topological space. I will give examples on the next slides, but basically, if you count those things, or more rigorously, to some of you who are very, very familiar with algebraic topology, the L of Betti number is actually the rank of the L homology group of this topological space. You add and subtract these L of Betti numbers in this following manner, you will get the Euler characteristic for the topological space, and here I'm interested in the Fermi C. That is the topological space that I'm interested in. So on this slide, let me give you some examples. In 1D, unless you have a field, completely field band, otherwise the only non-zero Betti numbers is the zero Betti number. That counts the connected components of your topological space. For example, here I give you a generic, a 1D dispersion, I put my chemical potential here so that I have two pieces of Fermi C. The number of connected components in this of this one-dimensional Fermi C is 2 because you have two pieces of it. Okay. If you change this chemical potential just gradually without merging these two pieces of Fermi C, then you're not changing chi f at all. It's a topological number. It's a robust integer. If you change this chemical potential rather drastically, such that it crosses a critical point in your dispersion relation, we call this a Lipschitz transition, then the two pieces, the originally two pieces of the Fermi C would merge and become one. Now you get chi f equals to one. Simple, that's just a very simple situation in 1D. If you have a completely filled band, your Fermi C extends across the whole Brillouin zone, the Euler characteristic is zero, because in that case, you will have B0 minus B1. For that Fermi C that extends across the whole Brillouin zone, B0 and B1 are equal. They all both equal to one. So for a filled band, the Euler characteristic is just zero. So this Euler characteristic chi f, it really is a measure, a topological measure for the metallic behavior, the gapless behavior of your metals. So it forgets about all the, you can have many, many occupied filled bands. And that's not something that I'm interested in this talk. For 2D metal, you will be interested in B0 minus B1. So if you have an electron pocket, then B1 is zero. You have, for each electron pocket, you have one connected component. So B0 is one for each electron pocket. Chi f equals to plus one. On the other hand, if you have a whole pocket, you will have B1 equals to two because you have two distinct non-contractible cycles. Generally, if you have some number of electron pockets and some number of whole pockets, then the Euler characteristic just adds up in this manner. Chong asked about the situation where I have an open Fermi surface. I can, well, one can easily cook that up by considering an array of weakly coupled wires. So here you have an open Fermi surface. In this thing, you can calculate B0 equals to one. You have one connected component of the Fermi C, and you have one family of non-contractible cycles. So B0 equals to B1, and that's why Euler characteristic equals to zero.
So these signs are kind of up, right? Because you can always do particle hole transformation to relate the two cases with plus or minus one, right?
Yes, yes. So it is particle hole odd for even dimension. The Euler characteristic of the Fermi C is particle hole odd in even dimension. In odd dimension, it is particle hole even. You can see it, kind of see it in the one dimensional example, whether you have a field band or, you know, whether you view it as occupied by electron or occupied by a hole, the Euler characteristic is always positive for the 1D case. For 2D case, then, yeah.
But are the probes you're going to discuss, presumably maybe they wouldn't tell the difference between chi f equals 1 and minus 1, because in some sense they're the same thing?
You mean they're the same thing? If you ask about the topology of the Fermi surface, then it doesn't distinguish between electron or hole. But in this talk, I'm interested in the topology of the Fermi C, and it does distinguish between electron and hole. I'm interested.
For example, it should be presumably invariant under a particle hole transformation. So,
could you repeat your question again?
It seems like entanglement should be invariant.
Yeah.
Particle hole transformation.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. That's a great point. I'll come back to that. So I can't use entanglement entropy to probe the Euler characteristic of the Fermi C in 2D. I have to consider another quantity which is related to entanglement entropy. We call it the charge weighted entanglement entropy, which actually have been used to characterize SPT phases. So I don't think it's a completely contrived thing that we cook up with. But that will be related to the odd cumulants of the number operators, which can be in turn related to the Fermi C topology in 2D. And that is particle hole odd. But in odd dimension, in 1D and in 3D, we can use the good old entanglement entropy, which is particle hole even, to probe the topology of the Fermi C. And in fact, in odd dimension, one could equally well speak of the topology of the Fermi surface instead of the topology of the Fermi C, because in odd dimension, the Euler characteristic of the Fermi C and the Fermi C, chi f, and the Euler characteristic of the Fermi surface, chi partial f, they are intimately related. But in odd dimension, in this talk, I would insist on talking about the Fermi C topology, because the surface, if I speak of Euler characteristic, is always zero. It's trivial. I can't probe that. Yeah. But I think a great question that I really want to address is, well, okay, a Fermi surface topology, the Euler characteristic is zero in 2D, but you can still count the number of Fermi surfaces. So whether one can find some correlation or response function to probe that, I don't know. But I think it would be interesting to think about that.
Yeah.
Okay. So so let us try to probe that without trying to do a quantum oscillation measurement. So, oh.
Just for your last comment, suppose we just want to probe connected component V of the fermi surface, then wouldn't the 2KF singularity do that? The 2KF? There will be many 2KFs.
How do you distinguish that from an ugly looking Fermi surface versus two?
Yeah, when you say a 2K, you really think about very isotropic Fermi surface? Is that right?
I'm not sure. Maybe it's possible.
Yeah. I don't have good answer to that. So how to probe the number of Fermi surfaces in 2D. Because I try to look for a clean, robust response that only picks out the integer number. But I hope we can discuss more about this. Maybe I can learn more about your suggestions after this talk. Okay, so the way that we try to do is to use entanglement entropy. And in response to Dominic's question, entanglement entropy with maybe an asterisk, so with a caveat. In 2D, I have to define a modified version of entanglement entropy. But I will talk about that when I get to that point, d equals to 2. So basically, we want to use entanglement entropy to probe chi-F, the topology of Fermi C. And we think it's possible because there are good precedents where entanglement entropy was able to probe something topological and or universal. For example, for d equals to 1 gapless critical system, you have this Cardi-Calabresi formula, which tells you that, okay, I will talk about that in the next slide, but basically the coefficient of the logarithmic scaling, that gives you the central charge C, it gives you a universal characterization of your gapless system. That can be reinterpreted as actually when you restrict your gapless quantum system to a 1D Luttinger liquids, that central charge C is actually telling you about the Fermi C topology, chi F in 1D. Okay. And there's another example in higher dimension. If you talk about gap topological orders, the Kitkov-Pruskal Levine Wan formulas actually tells you that there is a universal constant piece in the entanglement entropy that probes the total quantum dimension of your topological order. So there are good examples where entanglement entropy can tell you something really important about the topology of a system. So that motivates us to consider entanglement entropy. So it's probably not necessary for this audience, but let me go over this very quickly. To calculate the von Neumann entanglement entropy, first of all, I have a full system, A and B, and I consider the ground state of this entire system, AB. It's associated with a density matrix, rho AB. I trace out degrees of freedom in B and get the reduced density matrix, rho of A. A is the region that I'm interested in. Then I can calculate rho A log rho A, take the trace, this is the entanglement entropy that characterizes the entanglement between region A and its environment. This entanglement entropy would generally scale with system size, although the usual intuition is that in 1D, if you have a gapped system, you expect area law, a boundary law, which means in 1D, the entanglement entropy shouldn't actually change with system size. But if you have a gapless system, it actually changes with system size in this logarithmic manner. And because this is a log, the coefficient in front of a log can be universal. It doesn't really depend on the UV cutoff, which is little a. You can change little a in whatever way you want. You can multiply a numerical factor of it, changing little a, that is just the microscopic details, but changing that doesn't affect the coefficients in front of the log. Coefficient is actually the central charge C that counts effectively the number of low energy degrees of freedom in your 1 plus 1D quantum critical system. For example, for Ising spin chain, C equals to 1/2. So you see this logarithmic finite size scaling done on spin chains by these people. So the thing I want to highlight here is that if you think about your 1 plus 1D critical system as a 1D electron gas, and actually allow you to add an interaction so you can speak of Luttinger liquids. That's totally fine. The key thing is that for Luttinger liquids, you can describe it using free boson CFT with central charge C equals to 1. So if you have one channel of Luttinger liquids, C equals to 1. If you have n channel of Luttinger liquids, this C, they can probe with a finite size scaling of the entanglement entropy, this C will be n. If you have n Luttinger liquids, that actually amounts to saying that I have n connected components of the Fermi C. The Euler characteristic for this one-dimensional electronic system, the Euler characteristic for the 1D Fermi C is actually n. It's the same as the central charge that you can probe when you do this bipartition, measure the entanglement entropy and see how it scales to some size, extract the coefficients. You can do this experiment and extract the topology of a 1D Fermi C. So this gives us hope that entanglement entropy can indeed probe the topology of 1D Fermi C. Now we can immediately generalize it and say, well, how about thinking about the finite size scaling of the entanglement entropy in higher dimension? Then we run into a problem. Because if you think about even for free fermion, the way that entanglement entropy scales with system size, it has area law, enhanced by a log, but the key thing is that it's area law. So for high dimension, you actually get something like L to the power of D minus 1 log L. So coefficients in front of a log, it depends on many microscopic details. It depends on how you do the bipartition and what is the shape of your Fermi surface. So this thing forbids us to get something quantized because I want a topology of the Fermi C. I'm not really interested in the geometry of the Fermi C or the Fermi surface. So the leading order divergence of the entanglement entropy doesn't have what I want. Okay. Do you have a question?
The question is, does the interaction between different components change the picture, change the coefficient here?
If you have a Luttinger liquid, you can add in interactions, repulsive or attractive. You're changing the Luttinger liquid parameter K, but the central charge is not changed. Luttinger liquids, no matter whether it's attractive or repulsive, the central charge is always 1. It is described by a free boson CFT. Depending on what your interaction is, the complexification radius would change, but it's always a C equals to 1 theory. So in this, at least in this situation for 1D system, interaction doesn't change the result.
Maybe this is a stupid question, but say I have interaction between different components, can I get like...
Between different components?
What? Between different components, can I have like...
I see. If I think about the relevant interaction, or maybe the marginal, I'm not sure, but if you just have, say, maybe density operator for one component times density operator for another component, I think you can re-diagonalize everything and you still have the, if you have n flavors that have some inter-flavor interaction, I think you can re-diagonalize the whole thing as long as the interaction is of a specific type. I don't know how general that is, but in my mind currently, if I just think about the simplest, the most relevant interaction that I can write down, then it's of the quadratic type. I can re-diagonalize my Hamiltonian, and I still have n independent flavor, and C still equals to n. So I think I can tolerate certain types of intercomponent interaction.
The claim is that for the intercomponent connection, intercomponent interaction, either they are of the quadratic type and you can re-diagonalize it, or they are irrelevant. Is that the statement?
Yeah. Now, of course, I can also write down, if you use the language of Luttinger theory, you can write down some cosine theta term and gap out your system. Then I get a total. So I think I can always write down some strong interactions and I will have a completely different system. Then what I'm discussing here wouldn't apply anymore. I think we can negotiate more about what are the specific situation where my discussion here would work, namely, using a finite size scaling of entanglement entropy, you can still probe the Fermi C topology, even though you have some specific type of interaction. But I think for general types of interaction, the whole story can change drastically. For example, you can write down interactions to gap balances.
So for your previous picture of the Lipschitz transition, at the Lipschitz transition point, what should I expect?
I I don't know. Because I can comment more on why I don't know at that point, because in the formulas that I'm going to derive, I can emphasize to you that I rely on actually having a finite Fermi surface. If my Fermi surface is a point, for example, when I go through a Lipschitz transition, or I have some singularities on my Fermi surface, then my argument doesn't work. So I don't know what the answer would be. Yeah. For example, for 3D, I can have a result for how the mutual information scale with system size for a vial semi-metal, which is electron doped or hole doped, so that I can have I have an electron pocket in 3D or a hole pocket in 3D. As long as the Fermi surface is large enough, then I have a conclusive result to tell you. I can tell you that the mutual information is going to scale with the system size as log to the power of 3, and there's a coefficient in front of it that is the Euler characteristic for the 3D Fermi C. Either for electron pocket or hole pocket, that number will be 1. Okay. But what happens when I'm at charge neutrality or when I'm at a bow node where the Fermi surface shrinks to a point? I don't know what the answer would be, because my calculation wouldn't apply there. Yeah. But I think it's an interesting question to see. Well, how would the finite size scaling be modified? Is it still locked to the power of 3? And would the coefficient still be 1? It's tentative to think that it may still be 1, because by going from a hole pocket to an electron pocket, in 3D, that Euler characteristic doesn't change sign. It's always 1. So maybe you're still expecting something non-zero there. In contrast, in 2D, if you go from an electron pocket to a hole pocket, that will be 0. Yeah, because you go from minus 1 to 1. I think Han has a question first.
Yeah, so in 2D, so say at least the free Fermi, we have some Fermi surface, I can understand the Fermi surface as a collection of Lattice liquid.
Yeah.
So I guess in that case, this applies. Like the coefficient is universal, and I can use the coefficient to decide your chi. But maybe with interaction, this breaks down.
I think even without interaction, you have a log for each wire.
Right.
But when you have multiple wires, you are going to multiply the log by the number of wires you have, right?
But I still have the universal number in front of L log L.
That's true. But that is a very extreme scenario where you're not only ignoring interaction, you're even, in some sense, ignoring coupling between wires.
Oh, I see.
Right.
I see. Yeah, right.
So I think that the key is really that if you look at the leading order divergence in the entanglement entropy, you can't extract an integer.
Tunneling between the wires would change that coefficient.
Yes. Because I think that is known by, I think, Israel Klitsch and collaborators. They have they actually have an explicit formula for free fermions that tells you how the leading order divergence behave. It will be linear system size L raised to the power d minus 1, if you're talking about d-dimensional metal, times log L. And there's a coefficient in front of that that is controlled by the shape of the Fermi surface. Yeah. So if you add in interwire tunneling, you don't need interaction, you only need interwire tunneling, that would change the shape of your Fermi surface.
Yeah.
And that changes everything in front of the log.
I see. Thank you.
Okay, we want something topological. So how do we get that? Sorry.
It's just that you're mentioning Lipschitz transition. Can you do some numerical Monte Carlo experiment, playing with the quantity that you proposed, something like that?
I would like to learn about quantum Monte Carlo calculation. I don't know how to do that. But I'm going to talk about a free fermion numerical simulation, which is very easy to do without invoking quantum Monte Carlo. So because if I'm talking about a free fermion system, there's a correlation matrix method. Or you don't need to evaluate the exponentially large reduced density matrix rho. You can evaluate a much smaller correlation matrix, two-point correlation matrix defined within a subregion. And using that quantity, you can calculate entanglement entropy and see how its size scale with system size. And I'm going to show you a numerical result that matches with our prediction. Yeah. But before I talk about that, let me gradually talk about what is the exact quantity that I claim can probe the topology of the Fermi C in 2D and 3D. So that's the case in 1D, but we want to generalize it. In 2D, even though there's this area law contributions that kind of mask the topological robust thing that I'm interested in. Chitaev and Preskill and also Levine and Wen, they taught us how to actually extract something robust. So, and universal. Yeah, there's a boundary law. But you can actually, so first of all, what they realize is that if you have a 2D topological order, after this leading order divergence, you actually have a constant piece that is topological. It measures the total quantum dimension of your 2D topological order. It basically tells you how many, if you are having an abelian topological order, this number is basically telling you how many types of abelian anions. So that is an important characterization of the topological order. You can extract that in the following way. If you cut your two-dimensional system into these three pieces, any two are neighbor to each other, and any three, and all three of them meet at a point, then you can form this combinations of entanglement entropy that exactly cancel out all the non-universal boundary law contribution. For example, you would say this boundary between A and C, it contributes to, say, S of A, contributes to S of C, also contributes to S of AB, because this boundary is a boundary of region AB, it also contributes to SBC. But this piece appears equally in these four terms, and they come with plus and minus sign that exactly allow this non-universal boundary law contribution to be canceled out, leaving you with the term that you want to extract, that is topological and universal. So this is what I would call a tripartite mutual information, and I'm going to make use of this terminology, generalize it to higher dimension, and that is the quantity that we can use and apply to extract the topology of the premise. So let me tell you the results for 3D. But actually, for general D, this is what I'm going to do. For general D-dimensional Fermi C, I can cut the system into D plus one parties and look at its D plus one partite mutual information. Then we're going to look at its finite size scaling. For example, in D equals to 3, you will look at a four partite mutual information defined in this way. It looks a little bit terrible, but it's nothing but just a very direct generalization of what I showed you in the previous page. These plus and minus and these subscripts, different combinations of regions, they all amount to cancel out all the non-universal boundary law contribution, giving you a hope to retain something topological and universal. What we found is that for D-dimensional metal, if you cut it in these four parties, any three of them meet at a single line, any two of them share a common plane, and all four of them meet at a point, then this combinations of entanglement entropy of these four regions would give you a log to the power of three scaling. Log to the power of three, meaning that you take the log and raise to the power of three. It's not taking log three times, okay? So that is the result in for a 3D firm you see. Formally, it looks like it generalizes the pretty well-known 1D results, because I can rewrite what Cardi Calabresi and Wilczek and friends known already about 1 plus 1D critical system. S of A plus S of B minus SAB, I can use it to define a two-partite mutual information. Then the Cardi Calabresi formula reduces to this form for a 1D electron guess. But in 1D, it scales as log to the power of 1. In 3D, it scales to log to the power of 3.
In the 1D case, does the combination of AB cover the entire system or not?
It covers the entire system. So, yeah. But actually, that is of some higher order technicalities, but I can comment on this. I can allow myself to have an even larger system outside. So for 3D, I can allow myself to have a region E that is outside. For 2D, I can also allow myself to have a region C that is outside. But that doesn't concern me. All I need is in D dimension, I want to have D plus one parties. You can have some other parties outside, but I want D plus one parties that have this kind of configuration. Any two of them share boundary.
Remind me, I don't remember. For the topological order in 2 plus 1D,
yeah,
the ABC tripartite mutual information, do we need stuff? Do we allow, is it possible to make ABC cover the entire system? Is that allowed?
I think you are allowed to have a region D outside. That's fine.
Am I required? Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is a good question. So if A, B, and C is the whole system, then I think this is actually zero. And that is also quite important because you can say that, okay, in 3D, I form this combination, I can probe chi f in 3D. How about you form this Kitaev-Preskill or Levine-Wen or combination? This combination, can you probe chi f in 2D? Chi f in 2D is actually zero. Oh, sorry, chi f in 2D is not zero. The order characteristic for Fermi surface is zero. Okay. Another thing that vanishes is actually this combination. If A, B, and C cover the whole region, this vanishes because SA cancel with SBC, right? Similarly, and SABC is a zero. Okay. So, okay, yeah. It's important for this topological order thing that you actually have a region D that is outside.
But for the surface, we can either have or not have it. Is that statement?
Say again?
I just want to make sure for Fermi surface, in the next slide, do you mean we can either have it or not have it?
Yes. It doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. I will show you why it doesn't matter. Yeah. Because the key thing is that I have four regions that meet at this point. I don't really care about what happens elsewhere, outside. I will show you why it is this part that matters. Yeah.
So AL is the size of A, B, C, and D here?
L is just a characteristic size. I don't have to specify it in detail, because just as this little a is actually not specified in detail. So it's just a characteristic size.
But if it is not, I can kind of understand, but it is not Q, can it still be a character? Sorry.
If I have a 3 plus 1 D CFT, and then I can compute some entanglement quantity like this, and it's a universal number at the same place, like the...
Yeah. I don't claim this to be a generalization of the Cardi-Calabresi formula to a three-dimensional or high-dimensional CFT.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And after all, I think the system that I'm interested in, metal with a finite Fermi surface, I think it's not at an RG fixed point. I still have a characteristic length scale, which is KF.
Yeah.
So,
if the chi can be understood as the A in D theorem.
I don't know. So for example, I think maybe that is a question that one can think about. If I'm not talking about a metal, but a semi-metal, a vowel semi-metal, I have my Fermi surface shrink to a point, I'm at this vowel node.
Yes.
Whether this will get changed to a different form where the coefficient is A, that will be very cool to probe.
Yes.
I've tried to look at this, and I don't think people have results that look like what we just described. So you have a finite size scaling that can probe A. I think is A probably appears as a constant term instead of a logarithmic scaling in 3D. I have to check more carefully.
In even dimension, I guess it's in front of the log term.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between even and odd dimension. In one case, it appears as a constant term. In one case, it appears as some log. Yeah.
Even dimension is in front of the log, and odd dimension is a constant piece.
Yeah. Yeah, I see.
You have the even dimension system. The space-time dimension is even. So, but I guess that's in front of the log, not log cube. So the cube looks...
This is the full part of mutual information.
I'd like to chat more with you later on. I recall I looked into this matter for a while, but I don't recall all the details. For example, I don't recall whether the coefficients in front of the log is A or a combination of A and C. Because in higher dimension you have both A and C, so I recall that there's some tricky thing, but I think people at Perimeter knows about this much better than I do. So I really want to learn from you guys, but I have to also go back and read about the details and then we can chat more. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry for being slow. I will try to speed up a little bit, but that is the result. And let me try to quickly explain to you how we get at this. At least explain to you how we get at this for free fermions. For free fermions, one can relate the entanglement entropy to cumulants of number operator. So So I think as Dominic alluded to, the entanglement entropy is related to the even order cumulants of the number operator. For example, when L equals to 1, Q squared connect a correlation function, that just measures the fluctuation or variance of the number operator. Q is the number operator. It counts the number of particles in a subregion. And for higher order cumulants, for example, the third order cumulants is written in this way. And these connected correlation functions of cumulants has a pretty nice diagrammatic expression as connected diagrams, okay, of m point, if you're talking about the mth cumulant of the number operator. This odd order cumulants does not appear in the entanglement entropy, but this odd order cumulants, particularly this guy, it is crucial to measuring the Fermi C topology in 2D. Okay, so you're seeing where I'm coming from, or where I'm going to. If I want to measure the order characteristic in 2D, I actually have to forego thinking about entanglement entropy, but thinking about something else that is related to the odd order cumulants of the number operator. So I will talk about that. But let me talk about 3D situation. To calculate the full part-time mutual information, I need to know how this entanglement entropy in each subregion behaves. That amounts to calculating this cumulants, okay, even or odd order. So I want to calculate that. To calculate that, you can just, if you know about the equal time density correlation, say in momentum space, then you can Fourier transform to real space and integrate over the respective regions. Then you can calculate the mth order cumulants of the number operator. And actually, the interesting thing lies in this object. First of all, translation invariance requires sum of momentum equals to zero. Okay. You may ask, in a solid, this can actually add up to a reciprocal lattice factor. I'm interested in the finite size scaling. So when a system size is really, really large, then how my quantity behaves. So I'm going to focus on a situation where this little q, the momentum weight vector, is small. So my condition would be the sum over q equals to zero. This rho is defined in this way. This is just the linear density operator, c dagger k, c k plus q, and integrated over the Brillouin zone. This gives you the momentum operator at wave vector little q. Okay. The really neat thing we found is that this quantities, when you integrate out, say, the d plus 1 wave vector, you will get it equals to chi f times a factor that determines the volume extended by this remaining d independent wave vector q. So first of all, I have to integrate out this little q d plus 1 because I have to satisfy my translation invariance condition. But once you perform this, this step, it just amounts to telling you that the density correlation function is intimately related to the topology of your d-dimensional Fermis. So let me try to motivate why this result is true. And actually, it's an exact result I want to highlight again, as long as this wave vector q is small enough. I don't have to take the q goes to zero limit. I don't require it to be vanishingly small. I only require it to be small compared to the characteristic size of the Fermi C. Okay.
This result is Fermi gas result or Fermi liquid result?
It's a Fermi gas result, yeah. So in 1D, then when you talk about the rho density, I can write it as partial x theta. That would give, it's actually proportional to k. So it's only when k equals to 1 for free fermion that the coefficients would be 1 times the number of subbands, the number of channels of Lagrange liquids.
Right.
So, right, this result is only for free fermion.
So for Fermi liquid, do you expect similarly you get modified by the Landau parameter, or it's more complicated?
I don't have the formula. It's definitely going to be changed. I don't know how it's changed exactly.
I see.
For 3D, not for 3D, for 1D first. For 1D, it's really easy to see why this is true. For 1D, you will have a rho, so 2 density correlation function. You can write that as an integral of FF bar. You can just get this simply by Wick's contraction. You can interpret this integrand, FF bar, as an interval. So let me view this integrand as an interval. Okay. There are two endpoints of an interval. One endpoint is k, where you evaluate the Fermi function f, and another endpoint is k plus q, which I use to evaluate f bar, which is 1 minus f. Okay. I represent this point k plus q as an open circle and k as a solid circle because ff bar is 1 when this solid circle is inside the Fermi C and this open circle is outside the Fermi C. And that is the only situation where your integrand is non-zero and it will equal to 1. And I'm talking about zero temperature limit. So if you move this interval completely outside the Fermi C, then you can see that this integrand is 0. Or if you move this interval completely inside the Fermi C, it will also be 0. The only way that it is non-zero is when this interval is around a Fermi point. In this very specific manner, that you will pick up 1 as your integrand. Then when you integrate, you will actually pick up the length of the interval, which is the absolute magnitude of Q. If you have n components of your Fermi C, then this integral will give you the number of components of Fermi C times the length of your interval, absolute magnitude of Q. So that is the very simple 1D result. In 2D, you'll be considering a 3-point density correlation. During the Wicks contraction, expanding out everything, you will get an integral of a product of F and F bar. I don't want to do it in real time, but if you stare at it long enough, just like very similar to what we did here in 1D, you can interpret the integrand as a parallelogram. Instead of an interval, you can view it as a parallelogram in 2D. And the 4 vertices of your parallelogram has important meaning. And these are the 4 corners, are the 4 momentums that appear, 4 momenta that appear in the Fermi functions in the integrand. So the key thing is, if you stare at it long enough, you'll realize that this integrand is only non-zero in the following 2 situations. Okay? When this solid black dot is the only point inside the Fermi C, and the other 3 are completely outside, then you will get F equals to plus 1. Or another situation is when your open K plus 1, K plus Q1, this open dot, is the only point outside the Fermi C. Then your integrand will be minus 1. Okay. So these are the only 2 situations. In all other situations, your integrand will be 0. So that when you do this integral, you're putting a parallelogram at different places around the Fermi surface, you will actually realize that for each electron pocket, the integral will give you exactly Q1 cross Q2 absolute magnitude that measures the area of your parallelogram times the number of electron pockets minus the number of hole pockets. For electron pockets, you get positive contributions because you get net contribution when you have a black dot inside the Fermi C. And you have a hole pocket, the situation will be reversed. The bottom line is this will give you the area of the parallelogram times an integer number that counts the difference of the number of electron and hole pockets, which is the 2D Fermi C Euler characteristic. And this is an exact result as long as Q1 and Q2, these are the 2 little wave vectors, are small compared to KF, which is the characteristic size of the Fermi C. So with this, we can get to the following thing, that if you consider you have in a d-dimensional system, you have d plus 1 parties, you can calculate a d plus 1 partite number correlation. For example, in 1D, you calculate QA, QB connected correlation functions, or in 2D, you consider QA, QB, QC connected correlation functions. The fact that you have this factor, which is measuring the volume of the d mutually independent wave vectors, that translates into having log raised to the power of d when you do the Fourier transform and integrate in real space. So first of all, at this slide, I'm not talking about entanglement entropy yet, but here I would like to highlight that if you look at the multipartite number correlations for free fermion system, then this is a well-defined, maybe even a measurable quantities. If I talk to a code atom experimentalist, then he or she can take a snapshot of your code atom systems and then go ahead and measure the number correlation in different parties. And furthermore, we ask them to measure this finite size scaling, they can read off the coefficients that is quantized to the topology of the d-dimensional Fermi C. And of course, I have to And a caveat here, this is only true for free fermions. Now with this established, we can relate this result for free fermions to entanglement entropy. For example, in 3D, I'm considering this combination of entanglement entropy, which defines my four-partite mutual information. If you use this result that relates entanglement entropy to cumulants of number operator, you'll realize that the Q squared term get exactly canceled out. It is nothing but just the intuition that the picture that I showed you, that the boundary law contributions get canceled out when you consider this combinations of entanglement entropy. What you will be remain with to leading order is this guy. Okay. When I use equal sign, I'm using it in a hand wavy way. You have higher order corrections. The leading order divergence comes from QA, QB, QC, QD connect correlation functions. And then this would be related to chi F. So that's the story for 3D Fermi C. This result in particular, I would like to highlight that while I derived it by imagining that I have a free fermion system so that I can use this result, actually in our paper we analyze what happens for Fermi liquids. For Fermi liquids, we don't have this result, but we have another result that relate entanglement entropy to a twist operator that can be written as e to the power iq. So if you start from there and do an RPA analysis, you can draw bubble diagrams and see how the entanglement entropy get renormalized by Fermi-liquid interactions. You take the n goes to 1 replica limit, because I'm interested in von Neumann entanglement entropy, then you can see that all the RPA corrections would vanish in this n equals to 1, n goes to 1 limit. But that is some peripheral technicalities that I don't have time to cover here.
So you're saying for Fermi-liquid, the red be hard, but the von Neumann.
The Reni would be hard. I don't have a conclusive result for that because I can't conclusively say that it is going to be renormalized. It appears like it is going to be renormalized, but I'm not really sure whether it is or whether it's just that I missed some cancellation, whether we missed some magical cancellations. I don't know. But for von Neumann, then it's rather easy to see that all the RPA corrections is multiplied by a factor of n minus 1 raised to some power. So when you take the von Neumann limit, then the corrections from Fermi-liquid interactions actually vanishes.
I see.
It's nice to see this because for one dimensional system, the Cardi-Calabresi formula, it's also not renormalized by interactions. But what is better about 1D is that for Reni entanglement entropy, it's also not renormalized by interactions. So maybe one can conjecture that whether in 3D, if you not talk about von Neumann but talk about Reni, whether that result, so for free fermions, we also have a similar result for Reni. It's just a different factor. But would that be renormalized by interactions? We don't know. Yes. Oh, sorry, yes.
So just to make sure, is RPA the same as Fermi liquid?
I think, to my understanding, yes. Because I think the Fock law for Fermi liquid is that the only not irrelevant, which is I think the exactly marginal interaction, is the density of the forward scattering interactions, and if you draw out the diagrams, I think they correspond to the RPA bubble diagrams. So at low energy, and I'm interested in the thermodynamic limit, the finite size scaling, so I think I'm content with only including those marginal interactions. Yeah. And those diagrams do not contribute to modifying this. Yeah.
And can you see if you start from the Fermi liquid and go to the permanence of instability?
Sorry.
If you go to the instability, you trigger by a negative Fermi parameter. You know that if the Fermi parameter is smaller than negative something, there's the instability.
Yeah. I think infinitesimal weak attraction would give me superconductivity. Mm-hmm. Like that, or?
Activity, but Fermi surface deformation.
Okay. I haven't considered that, Fermi surface deformation. I don't know how to talk about that. I would like to learn more about that, but I don't have anything to say about Fermi surface instability.
Does this result depend on like the shape of the entanglement cup. We know that, for example, in CFT, if the cup is smooth or not, we'll change the shape of this formula. I'm not sure for your Fermi surface case or Fermi sig case, if the form of the something like this correlation will depend on the shape of the entanglement cup.
Yeah. So what it does not sensitively depend on is the angles, the solid angles that define the subregions. So I don't care about that. So right. So let me also talk about a 3D, a 2D case. So even for I'm going to talk about the 2D situation. I'm going to modify the definition of entanglement entropy to a charge weighted one. So similarly, you can consider this combinations of charge weighted entanglement entropy, and then this partition will give you this. So it's easier to answer your question when I look at this picture. So you would ask, well, does this angles matter? It doesn't matter, with an asterisk. So as long as all these angles are smaller than pi, then I don't care about what their value is. But there's a critical situation where one of the angles is larger than pi, then this coefficients would change to a different values. Okay. But there's a higher order technical details. Yeah.
To a different topological value.
Or yeah, basically you can think about this 3 would change to a different number. Yeah. And that maybe is this a public recording or something like that?
Okay. It's recorded.
It's recorded, okay. But let me say this. So I'm interested also in the corner contribution of a specific region. Here I'm talking about multipartite entanglement because I combine this in different regions. And you may ask, if this information, chi f, is encoded in this combination, then is it actually encoded already in a specific term? The reason that when I motivate this, I didn't want to consider a specific term because I have non-universal contributions. I want to use this to cancel them out. But if you say that, let me not ask the question of how easy it is to extract the topological piece, but ask the question of whether it exists, maybe as a subleading term. Then yeah, maybe the corner contributions of S of a specific region, charge weighted or not, it depends on in which dimension you're talking about. But let me be hand wavy on that. Looking at entanglement entropy of a specific region, but think about this region as singular, so you have some corners, then does that corner contribution behave universally and then capture chi f? And that is a question that I'm interested in addressing. Now, to some of you who are familiar with this kind of studies, people have considered corner contributions in integer quantum Hall or fractional quantum Hall, and a situation where you have angle theta that is pi is a critical situation. So I think it is quite similar here. If you have one of a region that is pi, that is a critical situation where something could change. So okay, how am I doing with time? Not very good.
We're not very strict, but yeah.
Yeah.
How
okay. How about say 10 minutes?
Yes.
Feel free to go on. Sorry. Yeah.
But
yeah.
We're not very strict.
Okay. So here I just briefly chat through. Okay. In response to Dominic's question, the entanglement entropy is not particle whole odd. It's particle whole even. But chi f, which is what I'm interested in, is particle whole odd. So I have to cook up for 2D, for even dimension, I have to use a charge-weighted entanglement entropy. This thing is actually related to something that I've been studied previously, used to characterize the SPT phase. So the good old entanglement entropy can characterize topological order, but a charge-weighted entanglement entropy can actually probe symmetry-protected topological phase, also as a constant universal piece.
Okay, but, I have a question on this. So,
yeah.
In principle, even for charge neutral fermion, I can have some Bogoliubov Fermi surface.
Hmm.
Charge doesn't seem to mean anything there, but I have Fermi surface, so you know many of the properties presumably should go through. So is there something
yeah.
that could make sense there?
Then, so first of all, my first question is, I think in that case, you probably wouldn't distinguish between an electron pocket or hole pocket because there's this particle hole symmetry.
Yeah.
So I can't talk about a Fermi C of those Bogoliubov quasi particles. The remaining quantity that I can speak of would be related to the Fermi surface of this Bogoliubov excitations. That kind of go back to the question that I touched upon, which I don't have answer to, that is, for 2D metal, can you find something that probes the Fermi surface topology? And that wouldn't be the Euler characteristic because it's zero, but you can still count the numbers of them. And I don't know how to count that. But for charge weighted entanglement entropy, then we have this result. And for free fermion, we can do numerical simulations, the correlation matrix method. I will go over this very quickly. I just want to show you some plots. So for triangular ladders, with an electron pocket, we can fit it pretty well. It's a quadratic in log. We can extract chi f equals to 1. For square ladders with a hole pocket, we can also get, you can see that it's bending in this direction. So it's signifying that the coefficient of log square is negative. And actually, in fact, you can extract chi f equals to pretty close to minus 1. So we have some numerical evidence to demonstrate that. Okay. So let me move on because I don't have too much time left. But I really want to advertise to you this thing, at least briefly. What I talked about previously are about something that one can negotiate how easy to measure. Entanglement entropy or mutual information is definitely not the easiest thing to measure. Number correlation or density correlation, maybe it's easier. But here for 2D, I think there's actually something even easier than those things that can be measured and by doing some transport measurement using a planar Josephson junction. So let me very, very, very quickly revisit the definition of Euler characteristic because I'm going to invoke another mathematical relation again. And that mathematical relation is really easy. To calculate the Euler characteristic of a two-dimensional system or two-dimensional manifold of a two-dimensional Fermi C, you can calculate that by going to the, by looking at some property about its boundary. It sounds like Gauss-Bonnet. It's not really Gauss-Bonnet. Gauss-Bonnet tells you that you can look at the curvature of the Fermi surface and you integrate it out, and you can get this plus one. So one over r, and then you integrate over the boundary, you get 2 pi. Okay, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the following thing. If you look at a critical point on the boundary. And the critical point is defined at our will. At my will, I'm going to define it in the following way. I'm going to define a critical point as the one whose velocity in the y direction is zero. So its velocity is completely along the x direction. Okay? You can change your mind. You can do a different definition. That doesn't matter. Okay? But let's choose my convention. So I'm labeling all the points that I call the critical points on the Fermi surface. These are the points whose Vy equals to zero. And there are two types of them. One type is convex critical points, which are labeled in red, and one is a concave critical points, which are labeled in blue. For an electron pocket whose chi f equals plus one, you have a one convex critical. So you have convex critical points on it. For a hole pocket, you have concave critical points on it. Now you can deform. Of course, you can deform this electron pocket a little bit and change the number of convex and concave critical points on the Fermi surface, but the difference in these two numbers is robust, and that is a topological thing. It's the Euler characteristic. For example, now when I pinch it a little bit, I create one concave critical point, but I have two convex critical points. So 2 minus 1 is still 1. Okay. So I also labeled an open red. These are just used to confuse you, so don't worry about it. I'm going to assume time reversal symmetry here. So the number of concave critical points with positive Vx will be equal to the number of convex critical points with minus Vx. I'm only going to use the solid dots. Okay. So the key thing here is just count the number of critical points that are convex and minus the number of critical points that are concave. So the key thing here is that if you want to measure chi f, measure something that is sensitive to the critical points. And in particular, measure something that is sensitive to whether the critical point is convex or concave. That can be achieved if you put a Josephson junction, a pi junction, on the normal metal that you're interested in. Okay. For the following reason. So, for example, this is the normal metal I'm interested in, and I have an electron pocket here. There's a properties about this Josephson junction that is sensitive to the Fermi surface critical point and sensitive to whether it is convex or concave. So first of all, it's rather well known that in pi junction, where the superconducting phase polar parameter changes sign, there are zero modes. The NGF states are zero modes. And when I say NGF states, I mean the superposition between electron and holes that get localized at this junction because of NGF reflection. Okay. NGF states have zero energy for the following reason. So first of all, I have planar Josephson junction, so I have translation symmetry in this direction. I'm going to label my quantum states with the good quantum number kx. Okay. Now, if this is my kx, if I choose kx to be here, then I can linearize around the Fermi surface and write down a BDG equation that describes the NGF states for this value of kx. Okay. The BDG equation would take this form. The tau z, this part is the normal Hamiltonian. I linearize around the Fermi surface, so it takes this linear dispersion term, this form. In the y direction, I don't have translation symmetry, so instead of py, I write down minus I partial y. And then I have a Dirac mass term that changes sign when I go from negative y to positive y, and that is because I want to consider a pi junction. So now I have a Dirac Hamiltonian where the mass term changes sign, so I have Jacquie-Farabi zero modes. So this analysis can be repeated for this value of kx. You also have zero modes. But if you keep repeating this analysis, you will see that when you talk about a kx that is close to the critical points on the Fermi surface, you can no longer linearize your dispersion. Okay? Because at this critical point, the dispersion in this direction is actually a parabola. Or effectively, your Vy is actually zero. So you don't have zero modes. It's actually it's really a critical situation. The thing is that for kx inside the Fermi pocket, your NGF state is zero energy. For kx outside, the energy of the NGF state will actually be split from zero. It will pick up some dispersion. Okay, so it's as critical as this situation. Which, if you watch the FIVA, you will know it's just as important as this critical situation. Okay. So if you solve this model exactly, what you will find is actually that first of all, your NGF states will have dispersion. So this curve is the dispersion of the NGF states. Forget about the color for the time being. You can see that if you're deep inside the Fermi surface or deep inside the Fermi sea, your energy is very close to zero. Way outside the Fermi pocket, the energy actually approaches the bulk band edge. Okay. Now let us look at the colors. Okay. I put on a color scale on this curve because I want to indicate the particle hole nature of this NGF state. Okay. Because the NGF state is a superposition of electron and hole, or if you write it out in a BDG two spinner format, you have the U component and the V component. This color, if it is red, it actually tells you that it is predominantly an electron. If it is blue, then it's predominantly a hole. Okay. So that is what my color scale means. Now, back to the first point. We have dispersive NGF states. That means if you are inside a junction, you are the NGF states, you will move. You move, and eventually you will move outside the junction. When you move outside a junction, you move into the normal lead, you will turn into either an electron or a hole. The key thing about the critical points on the Fermi surface is that whether it is convex or concave determines whether the NGF states, when it enters the normal lead, whether it becomes an electron or a hole. Okay. For simplicity, let me just consider the case where my Fermi C is an electron pocket. So, and in particular, I focus on the region around the convex critical points. My NGF states disperse in this way, and the particle hole nature of the wave function is like this. Okay. Now, I consider a situation where I have a narrow junction. So inside a junction, I have a minimal number of NGF states. As I move out of the junction, W, which characterizes the width of the junction, should increase. So let me try to increase it, and let us look at how the color changes. The color represents the nature, the particle hole nature of the NGF states. Okay. So let me focus on specific energy. Okay. I'm doing adiabatic approximation. So I fix my energy and see how my wave function changes. Okay? So this is how it changes. Right? So at first, it looks yellowish. It's a superposition of electron and hole. But as you increase W, as you move outside the junction, you will turn into red. Okay? That is the situation where you where this NDRFC is associated to a convex critical point. The story would be flipped completely if you look at a positive energy NDRF states, which are associated to a concave critical point, then it will turn completely into a hole. With this, you can, let us do the following thought experiment. You have a planar disposition junction, and then let us do a transport measurement along the junction. Okay. That is not the conventional direction that people do, that people play with disposition junctions. But what we found is that if you think about an unconventional way of playing with Josephson junction, you actually get something topological that probes the Fermi-C topology. You have two leads that connects to the two sides of the junction. And let me make everything grounded except for this left lead. I'm going to bias the voltage. So if I make a V negative, it's like injecting positive energy electrons into the junction. Depending on how many numbers of convex critical points I have in the normal metal, then there will be the same number of electrons that can propagate through the junction and get to the other side. Well, inside a junction is NGF states, but when it passes through, goes to the other side, it will become a definitive electron again. But the number of electrons that can get through is controlled by the number of convex critical points on the Fermi surface of the normal metal that is being proximitized by the junction. On the other hand, on the other hand, if you have a positive bias voltage, you are injecting positive energy hole excitations into the junction. The number of holes that can get through is controlled by the number of concave critical points you have. So if you measure the I2 V1 characteristic, you will see this characteristic graph. Positive or negative bias voltage will give you different ohmic behavior. The slope is controlled by the shape of the Fermi surface. Now, you may disagree with me because you might have not adopted the same convention as I did to define the critical points on the Fermi surface. Because it's also affected by how you lay down your junction. The way you lay down the junction would also affect how you define critical points on the Fermi surface. So the thing I want to say is that CE and CH, these individual numbers, they could change depending on how you do the experiment. The key thing is that the difference between them is independent of how you do your experiment, how you orient your junction with respect to the underlying lattice that defines the metal. So this difference is topological. That's something you can probe.
Does the junction have to be straight?
I need to have a straight junction. But, well, you can have it be curved, but I hope you do it slowly so that my adiabatic approximation is still valid. Yeah. So I assume adiabatic approximation here. I assume ballistic transport here. Yeah.
So presumably, it doesn't look like curved liquid will curve anything here.
I think not, because I gap the system. I put it approximatized by superconductor, so I open up a gap. So maybe that gap helps suppresses interaction effects. So that is our hope, and that is an advantage of this experiment. I will end now. The last thing I want to highlight is that with this picture in mind, there is a rectification effect here that can be manifested in this setup. You apply a AC alternating voltage bias here, and then you pick up a DC current on the other side. The size of the DC current you pick up on the other side is quantized by Kaya. I would like to end the talk here. So I think I'm way over time, but thank you very much for staying with me, and thank you for the very great discussions. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Omar, for a very nice talk. So, more questions? We have plenty, but you have one last question.
So could you remind me why the entanglement
entropy or the thing you proposed can be calculated via less density or charge-charge correlation.
Okay. It is basically this. So we have our own way to relate entanglement entropy to the cumulants of number operator. But this result is actually known early on by different people. So if you just want to know this result without knowing how to derive it, then this is the relation that relate entanglement entropy to cumulants of number operator. The intuition is that in a charge conserving system, if the two regions don't exchange particles, then there's no way that the two regions can get entangled together because they are just simply disconnected. Then S of A should be zero. And if region A and its environment exchange particles fiercely, that can be quantified by the fluctuations of number operator. I think people all actually call this the full counting statistics. Actually, the full counting statistics contain more than this, because I think full counting statistics means you have all cumulants of the number operator. And turn out, entanglement entropy is a particle whole even quantity. It only concerns the even cumulants of the number fluctuations.
So if I have some other symmetry in the system, then do I need to add other charge for other symmetries to this formula?
For
example, I have a spin symmetry, then does this formula have some general?
So when I write this, I was thinking about this as applying to the free fermions. But I think if you have a spin system that you can map to a free fermion system, you can have a related form that looks like this, but not using the Q of A, but maybe using some spin operator and raise to some power and see how the spin expectation value fluctuates. That would also be related to the entanglement entropy in that spin system when you do the bipartition. I think that a very nice paper, so let me just go back to that page because I think there's a very nice reference that you can look at that talks about that. So I think this paper, Song PRB, so I think you just type in Song PRB and bipartite fluctuation entanglement entropy. These keywords would guide you to this paper where they analyzed a bunch of systems, not just free fermion, but actually spin systems, and relate entanglement entropy to a cumulants of, for spin systems, it will be spin operators.
And I want to make sure this quality you propose is something like a Fermi C property, not a Fermi surface property, right? The quality.
This will be a very careful way to put it, and it will be necessary to put it if I am interested in an even dimensional metal. But in odd dimension, you can interchange the idea of Fermi surface and Fermi C.
Yeah, I guess for even dimension, once I have a Fermi surface, I guess geometrically, I can always complete it using a Fermi C, right? So in that sense, am I also probing my Fermi surface?
So, yeah. Now, if I just have the Fermi surface, but without telling you, But if I tell you that, yeah. A related comment to that would be, let me go to the conclusion page, sorry. This result, that it is not renormalized by Fermi-liquid interactions, may be intuitively understood as that as saying that this coefficient, instead of interpreting it as probing the topology of the Fermi C, it's really you can also relate it to the topology of the Fermi surface. And Fermi surface is something robust under interaction. So maybe that's why this is not renormalized by Fermi-liquid interactions. This is going to be renormalized by interaction. But I think you're right. If I give you the Fermi surface and tell you on which side you fill in particles, the Fermi C topology may still be think about it as may still be thought of as some Fermi surface probably or something close to
kind of thing, right?
It doesn't depend on details of how you continue into the bulk. Maybe. So we don't have a result that is stable under interaction, but it doesn't mean that there cannot be. Maybe it's just that we haven't found it yet.
I see. So you're saying the technique you use for the 3D thing doesn't apply for the...
No. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Is there an analogy of Q for general interacting in CFT or general interacting system?
Q?
Yes, chart operator that you was talking about.
I think, in my understanding, it's straightforward to consider this. As long as you have a conserved symmetry, you can think about, you know, the generator for the symmetry.
So you have multiple conserved symmetry.
Yeah.
Or non-abelian conserved symmetry. Just
yeah. Oh, you're saying that, oh, whether considering the fluctuation or cumulants of those things can give you something. Yeah. I think that would be interesting. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think people like Cheng Meng and also I think collaborators and maybe also someone here at Perimeter may have done some related works, right, on using evaluating the expectation value of, I think they call it disorder operator, e to the power I, some symmetry operator. So look at the expectation value and try to see whether there's some universal contribution. So that guy is, when you do the cumulant expansion, e to the power iq expectation value, it is intimately related to the full counting statistics of the corresponding charged operator. Whatever symmetry you're talking about is associated to a charge. And this e to the power I charge expectation value, that is related to the cumulants of the charge. And I think currently people are trying to extract useful information from that by considering different types of symmetry, abelian or not.
In your context, you were talking about fermilation. So in your fermilation situation, is the Q the same charged operator for the U1 symmetry that you mentioned?
Yeah. When I say yes, the answer, when I say yes, I would follow up on saying that the result is not robust. So you can calculate the good old, you know, charge, number operator, and look at its connected correlation function. In the free limit, it will be quantized to chi f. When you have interaction, it's going to be changed. Yeah. Now you can ask, if I renormalize my Q, but I think one have to come up with a good recipe to renormalize the Q in a meaningful way, and then look at the connected correlation function of that modified charge, and then say that it's quantized. Because I think I can always absorb that renormalized factor into my definition of Q, and that is a boring way of claiming that I found a correlation function that is robust under interaction. I think it's a great question to ask. For example, I think if I think about 1D, if I think about charge transport, for example, Landauer, that is related to correlation function or response function of two charge operator, that is going to be renormalized by the Luttingen parameter K. So in other words, if you look at Landauer conductance, that is going to be renormalized by K. Now, of course, there's this debate about if you connect it to leads are Fermi liquid, so the experimental results are not going to be renormalized. But if you look at finite frequency, then the charge-charge correlation function or charge-charge response is going to be renormalized by K. But thermal transport is not. So one can relate thermal transport to, I don't know, maybe energy correlation function, but I don't know how to think about that. So maybe there's a really meaningful way to modify this guy, which may be connected to thermal transport or something like that, that we can say in a more meaningful way why that correlation function is robust. Yeah. I hope I'm clear enough. It's not clear to myself, even to myself. So I'm not 100% sure what I'm talking about. But maybe the quick answer is that if you use this good old Q, the number operator, the pristine number operator, it's not robust under interaction. Yeah.
can I first also ask one more question? So about the 2D result, you basically weight entropy by the Q minus Q average. Right? And am I allowed to consider any other R function? Or that is kind of essential? Or like Q minus Q average to some other powers? Or...
Oh. Okay. I think it's... If you consider cube, then you probably don't have the QA cube term. You have some higher order terms, maybe. So I'm not completely sure, but my immediate response is that I need, however you define it, I want to have the QA cube term because it is the QA cube term that can be combined to give me QA cube EQC connected correlation function. That proves Kaya. So you don't have too much freedom.
I see.
To do with that.
And conceptually, how should I understand the physical meaning about this quantity?
I don't have a good I'm not even sure whether that's a good entanglement measure.
Right.
Because a good entanglement measure, first of all, I think it's always non-negative. This is negative. This can be negative, and you have to satisfy some monotonicity. You know,
right?
It's probably not a good.
Or maybe I'll ask a simpler question: if this quantity is zero, what does that actually tell you?
I don't know conclusively. But one situation where it can be zero is really the case where A and B are not entangled, because then QA minus QA bar will be zero. But that is not the only situation where this can be zero. So when A and B, they do not talk to each other, just as when S of A itself is zero because A and B don't talk to each other, this would similarly vanish. But can I say something meaningful in the converse direction? That when it is zero, does that mean uniquely that something happens or something does not happen? Now, I don't have that statement.
All right. Nothing else. Let's thank Paul Mackin.
Thank you very much.